You'd be goofy not to listen to the Disney Nerds podcast.
Welcome to the splendor, the spectacle, the sparkling sensation, where the romance, the comedy, and the thrill of Disney fantasies come to electric life.
And as our friend Jiminy said, welcome. Welcome to the Disney Nerds podcast, a place each week where like-minded people get together to discuss all things Disney. We'll help you get your Disney fix on. Here we go.
A Magic Kingdom proudly presents, in a million points of musical light, the magical worlds of Disney.
Hello and welcome to show 207 of the Disney Nerds podcast. Hey guys, this is Jimmy, and this week I have Charlotte with me. Hello, Charlotte.
Hi, Jimmy. So nice to be here with you.
I am so happy to talk to you. And this week we have a special guest, and we're very honored and happy to have Jeff Barnes. Jeff, how are you?
I'm well. How are you guys?
I am fantastic. We're so happy to have you on tonight, and we appreciate your time. We know your time is very valuable to you. Jeff is the author of two books, The Wisdom of Walt, and what's the second one is?
Beyond the Wisdom of Walt. So the first book, the first book focuses really on Disneyland, and the second book is focused more on Walt Disney World.
That's fantastic. I love the two titles of that. So just give us a brief overview, and this is something that we ask all of, and you know, every guest that we've had on the show, Jeff, but tell us, what makes Jeff Barnes a Disney nerd? And whether that's a story of how you became one, or, you know, most of us, we like the little details, we like the little behind the scenes stories and that type of stuff. So what makes you a Disney nerd?
Well, I think my number one calling card is I teach the world's only accredited college course on the history of Disneyland. And the way all of that started, I actually grew up in Florida and went to my first Disney park, which was Walt Disney World in 1974. And even at age 10, the first time stepping onto Main Street, I'm like, whoa, this place is different. And I just sort of instantly became that person who, if for whatever reason, if we were going back to Walt Disney World, whether it was a family vacation, school trip, it didn't matter. I was always looking forward to it and always counting down the days. And I actually didn't get to Disneyland in Los Angeles until I was in grad school in 1988. And I write about this in the first book. I was unbelievably disappointed. It was small. It was underwhelming. I knew nothing about Walt, nothing about his dream for a place where parents and children could have fun together. We stumble in on a Sunday morning in August around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. And the big new attraction that had been advertised on television all year long was Star Tours. And Tomorrowland here in California is located right off of the Central Hub, just like it is in Florida. So I knew how to find Tomorrowland. And as soon as we got into the land, I asked a cast member, hey, where's Star Tours? And the good news is we were in the right place for the ride, but the wrong place for the line. So we got redirected back to the very beginning of Main Street, and it took 3 hours for us to experience our first Disneyland ride. And by that point, the park's more crowded, it's even more hot. And by the end of that night, I was done. I was out. And if you had said to me, hey, you're going to turn into a Disney nerd, you're going to end up teaching a college course, writing books and traveling the world, talking about all things Disney, I would have said you're absolutely nuts. But I ended up returning with a group of young people 3 years later. And by that point, I had lived in California long enough to realize, even more than the residents of Florida, man, this park matters to people. There's a connection. There are some deep roots. And I got really curious, which is one of the things that Walt always encouraged and what he identified as a secret to success. I got really curious about Walt and this dream for Disneyland. And that's when I came to discover Walt, like almost all of us, wasn't born successful. He, in fact, had more failures than success. And even at the age of 53, Walt Disney couldn't just speak the words Magic Kingdom and Disneyland appear magically out of an orange grove in Anaheim. And so it was his story with all of the difficulties and obstacles and adversities and the way in which it connects to our own stories that really helped me fall in love with Walt Disney, Disneyland, and really fall in love with Walt Disney World all over again.
That's great.
I have not had the pleasure of going to Disneyland yet. We're going to be going down to – I live in New Orleans. We're going to be going down to Walt Disney World in about 2 weeks – a little less than 2 weeks I'll be going down for our Disney Nerds podcast meetups, which and that'll be the my fourth trip to Walt Disney World this year.
Wow.
So we go to Disney – and obviously living in New Orleans, it's much more convenient for us to go to World than land. And I'd love to go to land. But on the show, you know, I think I'm one of the only ones that's never been to Disneyland. But we always talk about that Disneyland is more of a locals park, where Walt Disney World is more of a vacation destination. Would you say that true?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. You have a million plus annual pass holders in Southern California. And, you know, part of the vision for building Walt Disney World was the realization that in the early 1960s, despite the success of Disneyland, only 8% of the guests were from east of the Mississippi River. And yet at the same time, at that point in our nation's history, more than 75% of the population lived east of the Mississippi.
Sure.
And so Walt, with all of the success in Southern California, readily recognized that there was an entire untapped market. And so when he built Walt Disney World, yes, it was about Epcot, and yes, it was about not making some of the mistakes that he wanted to avoid here in Anaheim. It was also about creating that true vacation kingdom of the world. And so today, it's exactly that. It is the world's most popular tourist destination and the nation's largest single site employer.
It's pretty incredible. And, you know, I think one of the things that really make me want to visit Disneyland, and look, listening to your story, I think it's funny because I'm mentally preparing myself to be a little bit underwhelmed. But with that being said, because I am a Disney nerd and I dig the history and the backstory and know the history of Walt and read his autobiography, that I'm looking for the connection to him more than being overwhelmed by the park, I guess, if that makes sense.
Well, here's what I would tell you. First of all, Disneyland is charming. There are aspects of this park in various nooks and crannies that I think scream Walt Disney more than anything that you'll find in Florida. Starting, of course, with the fact that Disneyland is the only Disney park that Walt himself ever personally walked in. They didn't even break ground in Florida until 6 months after he passed away in December of 1966.
Sure.
Walt Disney World is spectacular. But at the same time, it's been said Disneyland hugs you while it can feel like Walt Disney World swallows you. And I don't know about you guys, but I'd probably rather be hugged than swallowed.
Yes,
and
absolutely true.
I do believe people don't realize this, but between the two parks at the Disneyland Resort versus, say, the four theme parks at Walt Disney World, we actually have more attractions here in California. And attraction by attraction, there are very few in Florida, in my opinion, and a lot of this is personal, but in my opinion, attraction by attraction, there aren't a lot in Florida that are significantly superior than the California versions. So, for example,
I agree with that.
Pirates of the Caribbean isn't even close. If you have only ever ridden Pirates in Florida, I would almost argue that you haven't really ridden Pirates of the Caribbean.
Agreed.
Most people think that Space Mountain is better in California. There are a few holdouts who, you know, believe that the version in Florida is better. The attractions in Florida that are superior, I think Haunted Mansion in Florida is a little bit better. I think the Jungle Cruise is a little bit better. Thunder Mountain, while different, is comparable. Splash Mountain, while different, is comparable. Mm-hmm. the ride that I like in Florida better than what we ever had here in California is the Hollywood Tower of Terror. And
oh, yes.
That's part of the reason why I wasn't that upset when they converted it to Guardians of the Galaxy here in California. And I love what they did, but if they had done that to the version in Florida, I would have been upset about it because I don't ever go to Florida, and we'll be there in a few weeks. I don't ever go to Florida that I don't make sure we get to the studios and I get to ride the superior version of Tower of Terror.
When are you going to be down, Jeff?
So we get there on the 22nd, and we'll be there through Thanksgiving week. We're actually on our way to Jamaica, where I have a couple of speaking engagements the following week.
Oh, great.
So you're going to the end of November.
Yes.
Okay.
All Christmas decorated.
I love it, yeah.
Well, we had originally planned to be there for the holidays because we've never been to Walt Disney World and seen that particular park or the resorts or what have you decorated for the holidays. And then when the Jamaica opportunity presented itself, I'm like, well, do we want to go to Jamaica until December 2nd and then turn around and fly back a few weeks later? So we just decided to fold it all into one trip and be at Disney World for Thanksgiving. It'll still all be decorated, and sure, you know, we can do gingerbread houses in the resorts and, you know, do the candlelight processional and what have you. So we're really looking forward to it because it seems to me like every time we get to Walt Disney World, it's like in the middle of July. And
right.
I'm looking forward to a bit cooler weather and a lot less humidity.
Absolutely.
We did Thanksgiving a few years back, and it was fantastic. It was we woke up one morning, and all the Christmas trees were in our resort lobby. And, you know, the Magic Kingdom and everything had already been decorated, but the resort had not really been decorated until, I guess it maybe was Tuesday morning we woke up and everything was decorated. Actually, my sister and I have to confess, we went out like 12:30 at night to the McDonald's while all the family was asleep so we could get iced tea. And so we came back and we saw them putting all the trees up in the lobby and everything. And we sat and watched them for a little bit. And she and I just had a sister moment. And it was really a wonderful family Thanksgiving at Walt Disney World. So you're going to have a great time.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. We were just there in July, and we were there in May, and we were there in April. And so this particular trip isn't going to be about running around to the parks and doing all of the different attractions and shows and rides. We really just want to take in the holiday atmosphere and go to the various resorts and see the lightings and the decorations that we don't have here
right.
at Disneyland in California.
I think,
and that's what we do when we do a Christmas trip too, yeah. is we specifically focus on the things that those things
yeah.
that we want to see the holiday. Yeah.
And what's sort of fascinating about that is back in 1959, after Walt had sunk $8 million into the Tomorrowland expansion at Disneyland, he then decided he wanted to do a Christmas parade. And, you know, his managers are like, Walt, we just spent $8 million. Why spend another $250,000 to do a Christmas parade? The people are going to come regardless. And Walt said, look, you can't take the people for granted. If we ever giving them more than they expect, then they're going to stop coming, and it will cost us even more to get them back. And so Walt was so visionary about knowing what the public wanted, exceeding those expectations, and, you know, making sure that there was always something to see, always something to do, which I believe has kept us coming back over and over again.
I agree. And there's been a lot of people that have disagreed about the different people that have run the Walt Disney Company since his passing, but they have always moved forward and focused on what the customer of that time was looking for.
Yeah. You know, I get a lot of people, you know, they'll sort of complain about things. And I mean, I'll tell you, Disney as a company is different than, say, Disney, the brand and the association that we have with Uncle Walt from 50 years ago. But at the same time, they are the world's largest entertainment company, and they're doing something right. They're not perfect, but they are certainly
right.
doing something right. And one of the, you know, biggest things I hear in Southern California is, man, nobody can afford to go to Disneyland anymore. Well, I was there on Saturday. That park was sure filled with a lot of nobodies.
Well, and I tell
that's
you,
right.
that's funny because, you know, we run a part of the Disney Nerds podcast. We have a Facebook group called Disney Nerds, and And I'm a member of other Facebook groups too, and you see a lot of people complain about the pricing. And you know, I always try and look at it from a reasonable point of view. And I don't like it when the prices go up either, but I understand that they're in an interesting predicament because it's a balance, right? They have to keep prices high enough where it's not over. If the prices are too low, then the parks are so busy all the time, everyone's miserable.
Yeah, I'm not saying everybody can afford to go to a Disney park, but it certainly isn't true that nobody can afford
to go. Absolutely.
The wait time at Haunted Mansion on Saturday night, which is easily one of the highest capacity attractions in the park, the wait time on a Saturday night in October was more than 3 hours long. Again, that's a lot of in line on a Saturday night. I have a chapter in the new book, Beyond the Wisdom of Walt, entitled Financing Your Future. And I do an interview with Walt from 1956 where he addresses the issues and the complaints about pricing a year after the park opened. And then there's an equal analysis from 2016 where it compares admission into a Disney park versus, say, you know, skiing for a day or going to an NFL game for a day. Everything's expensive in 2017. And entertainment is especially expensive. And I'm not telling you that a day at Disney is cheap, but I'm telling you, you get value for your money.
I was going to say, and what I always tell people is, it's a premium product. You have to pay a premium price.
Yep.
It's supposed to be. And let me tell you, if you look a daily ticket, which is what, $100, but that's not really what Disney is designed for, right? They're looking for the week-long guest, really. In the big scheme of things, they're looking for somebody that's coming in for a week. And when you buy a 5 or 6 day ticket, it breaks down to about $40-$50 a day.
Yeah, you can't. Passes here in Southern California, and people don't realize it. At Walt Disney World, they are way more in the hotel business than they are in the theme park.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely.
27,000 hotel rooms.
Yeah. So go back to 1955, and Walt's opening up his amusement park, and his wife doesn't believe in it. His brother Roy doesn't believe in it, and they're getting 800 calls a day asking about overnight accommodations. And Walt goes to Hilton. They won't build a hotel because this place is going to be gone and bankrupt in 6 months. Sheridan tells him no. Marriott tells him no. And so the Disneyland Hotel ends up getting built by his friend Jack Rather, producer of the Lassie and Lone Ranger television show. And in return, Walt gives him a 99-year lease and use of the Disneyland name. Well, today, if you were to spend a different night in a different room at Walt Disney World, it would take you 70 years before you ran out of rooms, which is pretty incredible for a dream that nobody wanted to invest in back in 1955.
That's so true. And I think about the week-long trip, and I think about what you spend per day, and when it all breaks down, and look, I'm not saying it's cheap, and believe me, I know it's expensive, but I don't. Let me tell you, you can't – if you go spend a week in Gatlinburg and go to Dollywood and the water parks, guess what? It costs about the same, and it's not the same product.
Exactly.
Yep.
Speaking of dreams, Jeff, you had a dream to actually teach about Disneyland and the history of Disney. Can you give us some idea of how that dream came to reality for you?
Sure. So I've always been kind of mesmerized by the idea that Walt is sitting on a park bench at Griffith Park with his young daughters, Diane and Sharon, in the 1940s. And he just has this idea, this crazy thought, this dream of a place where parents and children can have fun together. And if you look around our world, I don't care what it is, everything is a byproduct of somebody's thinking. And so Disneyland and Walt Disney World and all of the other parks that bear his name are a byproduct of that singular thought on that park bench on a Saturday afternoon. Well, after Nikki and I moved to Southern California in 2011, and I was already all in on Walt and Walt Disney World and Disneyland, Nikki, interestingly enough, had never actually been to Disneyland until our honeymoon. in 2009. And so here we are 2 years later. We're moving to Southern California. We're excited because we're going to get to go to Disneyland. We're going to become local annual pass holders. And we're walking around the park one day, and sort of like Walt on that park bench, I have my own idea, crazy thought. I start to have my own dream, and that is, wow, you know, I'm dean of student success at a local university. I teach history courses. What would it look like if there were a college course on the history of Disneyland? And almost like all of our ideas and crazy thoughts and dreams, the second I began to think it, I also began to doubt it. I didn't want to be the university professor who lost his job for what was so obviously a Mickey Mouse idea. And so I did with my dream what too many of us do with our dreams, and that is, well, nothing. And yet it kept haunting me over the next couple of years. I'd find myself distracted in the middle of the day. I'd wake up in the middle of the night. You know, what am I going to do with this thing? And to sort of make a long story short, I ultimately went in to my boss, the chair of our history and government department, and pitched my Mickey Mouse idea and learned, whoa, he had worked as a cast member 30 years ago when he was a student at USC. And so despite all of my fears and all of my doubts, he actually loved the idea. And so for a year, I got to work on that dream. And, you know, the class has a syllabus and it's got textbooks and, you know, the lectures are all laid out. And, you know, we go out and we get, you know, folks to come in and give guest lectures. And we take a field trip to the park and we take a field trip to Garner Holt Productions in San Bernardino. And today they're the largest maker of audio animatronics anywhere in the world. And, you know, bam, you know, we're living this dream. We give the very first lecture. And as I write about in the first book, the day after I gave that first lecture in that dream class, I was actually diagnosed with a brain tumor. And the neurosurgeon at Cedars-Sinai wanted to operate immediately, which would have meant, because of the invasiveness of the surgery and being out of work for about 8 weeks, that the class would have been canceled and that would have been the end of the dream. And I remembered Walt. You know, Walt went bankrupt at age 21 in 1923 following the collapse of Laugh-O-Gram Studio in Kansas City. And what changed his life and changed his dream and ultimately changed the world was him going all in on animation. You know, he boards that train, comes to California with $40, a single suitcase, and a one-way ticket. And I'm standing there in the neurosurgeon's office in Cedars-Sinai, and I'm like, Walt went all in, and I need to do the same. And so I refused to have the surgery until the class was over, which meant delaying everything for 2.5 months. And, you know, the good news is we taught the class, and, you know, the surgery was successful. It turned out not to be cancerous. And here we are 2.5 years later. We teach the class every summer, and we've written now two best-selling books as a result of the experience, and we get to travel the world speaking about it. So
that's fantastic.
Jeff, I'm listening to your story, and it just reminds me of something. It reminds me of a song from, and it's not Disney, but it has a Disney tie. About less than a year ago, me and my wife went to see Finding Neverland on Broad, like not like the Broadway show, but it traveled here to New Orleans. And there's a song called If the World Turned Upside Down. And it's a song that J.M. Barrie's singing, and it's kind of like that. It's kind of like he's singing that he finally listened to his heart, and you know, he'd kind of accepted things a certain way, but it always kind of felt wrong, and he always had this thing inside of him to tell him just to do it. And that's what it sounds like, and that's kind of, you know, their depiction of how J.M. Barrie felt before he wrote Peter Pan, because everybody thought he was a nut job. Because, you know, it was about little kids that don't age and flying ferries and, you know.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah,
the way I think about it is, in 1955, the world needed Walt Disney because the world needed Disneyland. And imagine the world today without a Disneyland, without a Walt Disney World, without all of the other parks around the world. And in 2017, I don't care who you are, but we need your ideas and we need your crazy thoughts and we need your dreams. And so I tell people all the time, I don't see going to Disneyland as an escape. I see it as an example. I don't see Walt Disney World as the place where dreams come true. What I teach about, what I write about, and what I speak about is how the parks can actually show you how to make your own dreams come true.
Sure, it shows that it's possible.
Exactly. And I write about this in the second book. You know, some see the world and ask why. I see Walt Disney World and ask, why not?
That's absolutely true. Why not? So, why not make?
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, I read both your books, and I absolutely loved both of them. They very much inspired me, and you are needed in this world to show us that we can live our dreams through magic and through the examples that you're bringing us from these stories of Walt. I mean, they're just fantastic. So I'm glad that you pushed forward. You kept moving forward.
Well, I mean, I appreciate the thanks, Charlotte. But you really have a brain tumor to thank, because you know, without having that sort of life and death, you know, are you or aren't you? Are you going to go all in or not? I'd still be sitting here thinking about it. I'd still be sitting here dreaming about it, because teaching the class was great. But in truth, the book idea had been dormant for 20 or 25 years. I told someone in 1991, hey, I'm going to write a book about Disneyland one day. And it took getting sick to get serious about it. And I said to Nikki after the recovery, I said, hey, it's great that I'm healthy again. It's great that I got to teach the class. And if that had been it, you know, I would have died at age 51 with only one regret. And Nikki being Nikki, she's like, one regret? Hey, that's pretty good. What's your one regret? And I said, I never wrote my Disney book. And she was like, well, then it sounds to me like we need to get serious about that dream next. And we did. And it's great that it's changed our life. But I think more importantly, I get to hear from readers every day how it's changed their life. And that is just so unbelievably you know, powerful and motivating to keep doing what we're doing.
I think it's fantastic, and I think part of it is Disney means so much to so many people, and it means different things to different people, right? So I completely get where you're going, and I agree 100%. And I think it's interesting because it stands for so much more that people than the common person would just understand. And you know, I've talked about this on the show before, but for me, it changed my lifestyle to want to be a better, more positive person.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. You know, that's kind of what it stands for me. I look at the people involved in the Disney community and the people like yourself and Charlotte and all the friends I've got to make, and I really try and live as a dreamer. I mean, when you think about it, you know, and try and always see the bright side of things. And like you said, not, you know, why not?
Yeah. I mean, the people that we have met in this journey and the Disney family that has welcomed us and embraced us are like unlike any other people that we've had the chance to encounter anywhere else in the world.
That's fantastic.
And you feel different when you are in a Disney park. You think differently. You behave differently. And I have the opportunity to write about why all of that is true and how you can potentially transfer that over into what you do each and every day. I think it's great to go to Disneyland. I think it's great to go to Walt Disney World. But, man, what would it look like if no matter who you are and no matter where you are, no matter what you do, if you could bring a little Disneyland, a little Walt Disney World to your day every day? And that's really what the books are about. Yeah. I tell, yes, it's about Walt Disney, and yeah, it's about Disneyland and Walt Disney World, and there's some fun facts, and you know, there's some history in there, but it's really about you, the reader, and how you can transform your life, and you can take your success to the next level, and you can see your own dreams come true.
Yeah, go in there and learn them lessons and take it for what it is, but don't leave it at the gate when you leave.
Exactly, which is why we designed the books the way that we do. Every chapter has a section that I call a souvenir stop. And, you know, you purchase souvenirs from the park and you take them home to kind of remind you and to help you remember all of the good times and good memories that you have from being there. And so in the souvenir stop of each chapter, that is an opportunity for the reader to stop and reflect and to write some things down and hopefully take them with you as you move forward in your life and keep going back to those particular applications as you work on the various areas that we address with regards to life and leadership, success, and dreams.
I love those sections in the book, Jeff. I mentioned in my review on our blog, on our podcast blog, that I had read this on the Kindle and advised everyone to get the hard copy. And I have gone back through my Kindle edition like 5 times because I am a quote person. I love great quotes.
Oh,
I
she's
love,
not lying.
I
she
do.
Posts them every day.
Every yeah. day, and I have ever since I started Facebook. But I love the quotes that you've used. I've loved the stories, and I love every chapter after I finished. I would close it, and even though I was ready to push on into the next one, I would take a moment to just absorb what you've said so I could apply it to my life. And one of the things I really resonate with is I didn't start going to Disney until after I had cancer. And It was a request from one of my kids. I did not grow up going to Disney World or Disneyland. And when my kid said, "Mom, we need to go to Disney World now that you're better." And okay, we went to Disney World. And I fell in love because of that magic and the feeling of just the optimism. And I needed that optimism so much in my life. I was an optimistic person, but I'd had cancer 3 times. Wow. I was beat down in my soul. I mean, that's hard to come through. And I can remember just getting so much out of visiting Walt Disney World that it became, I wouldn't say an obsession, but some might. And but it really is my happy place, and I can take that and bring it back into life. And a lot of what I experience at Walt Disney World or Disneyland, between the cast members and how they relate to customers or the guests, I can take forward into my life. They treat me nice, and I work part-time in the retail environment, and I take a lot of that Disney-fied, you know, employee thought to my own job because it provides magic out here in my world. And so I really loved the way that we had the souvenir stops in the book, and it really gave me something to take with me into the next chapter and into my life after I finish the book.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about all of that is, as you share your story, you don't mention a single ride or a single show or a single attraction. And that is really what separates the Disney parks from all of the other amusement parks. And I've got a quote. There we go with quotes again. I've got a quote on the Wizard of Walt, where, you know, if you take an amusement park and you remove all of the rides, it's a parking lot with popcorn. But with Disney, if you remove all of the rides, it's still a theme park. And so you have this feeling, and it's just infused in everything that you do and everywhere that you go and everyone that you meet and everyone that you encounter. One of the stories that I tell in the first book and I get to reflect on in the second one is after my brain surgery in 2014, while it wasn't cancerous and I was able to recover, I was also banned from riding amusement park rides for 2 years. But that doesn't mean we went to Disneyland any less, because again, yeah, the rides and the attractions are nice, but it's really about so much more. And I got to experience that at a completely different level when I'm at Disneyland and I'm absorbing the atmosphere, but I'm not racing to get on Space Mountain because I'm not medically allowed, or I'm not racing to get to Splash Mountain because I haven't been medically released. And so that experience alone just took me to a whole nother level of depth and appreciation.
You know, I think that's a very interesting point, because one of the things, and we talk about this, you know, obviously these are Disney-related podcasts. We talk about different tips and things we give to people. And, like, my number one tip all the time is, if you go to a Disney park, slow down. It's not mm-hmm. about running down Main Street to get to Space Mountain. It's just not. Slow down.
Yeah, you miss the details when you do that.
You do. Stop. Slow down. Look around. Take the turn down. Go down the dead end street. Look around for a little while. Listen. What separates Disney from every other park, and you just said it, you know, if you remove the attractions from most, you got a parking lot. What separates Disney is their great attention to detail. And when mm-hmm. you're just, and you, I don't want to say it bothers me, but I guess in one way it does, is that it doesn't bother me, but when I'm there and I see people just flying by and they're so absorbed into trying to get to the attraction, I think to myself, man, that's the people you hear complaining. I don't see what all the fuss about Disney World is. Yeah, because you didn't go and do it right.
you didn't have somebody point you in the immersion of the story.
You didn't experience it correctly.
When I teach my History of Disneyland class, I have yet, and we've been it for 4 summers now, I have yet to have a single student in my History of Disneyland class that has ever been there for rope drop. Now think about that for a second.
Wow.
I mean, they grew up in Southern California. They grew up going to Disneyland, and yet somehow they missed what I think is one of the most magical park times of the day, and that's in the morning when, you know, you can almost have the park entirely to yourself. And as part of the tour that I give, you know, we go on the Storybook Land Canal Boats, which is a very Walt-centric ride. We go on the Casey Jr. Train in Fantasyland, which is a very Walt-centric ride. We, at the end of the day, take one of the vehicles down Main Street. And almost to a student, not only have they never been there for rope drop, but they've never done any of these other, like what they would consider to be a small or minor attraction. And yet it's really the heart and soul of what Walt wanted in a place where parents and children could have fun together. They're used to getting there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the park is absolutely mobbed, and they get in line for Space Mountain for 2 hours, and they go home. And I hopefully show it to them at a completely different level.
You have me wanting to go to summer school and come out there. I mean, that would be fantastic.
And I promise you, Jimmy, you will not be disappointed, and you absolutely will not be underwhelmed by Walt's first Magic Kingdom.
I'm going to call you, and I'm going to have my own Jeff Barnes personal tour guide.
We give them all the time. We just gave one to 5 people on Saturday.
I bet you do. Living there, I'm sure you do. And I'm just teasing, but I would definitely let you know when I was out there.
Would love to do it.
My first trip was this past summer during D23. So I went out to D23 and I got to spend a few days at the Disneyland parks, and we stayed at the Disneyland Hotel. And I'm not gonna lie, I cried a little when I got into Disneyland. It wasn't because I was underwhelmed. It was because I was so emotionally charged with the essence of Walt. I mean, it just was, it really was amazing. The quaintness, it just, Jimmy will love it. And we're going to get him there soon.
It's coming.
Sounds great.
It's in the plans, I promise.
Yeah, let's do it. And you're going to Florida even more, and you're going to be able to go back to the origins and the roots and really immerse yourself in some history and see things from Walt's eyes that you don't get quite that same perspective in Florida.
All right.
That's awesome. I truly look forward to it.
Jeff, and beyond the wisdom of Walt, it is more about Walt Disney World, but I really love that you focused a lot on Epcot. I learned a whole lot about Epcot that I did not know. And as I was leading up to the Epcot's 35th anniversary, it just was even better to read to me. What are some of the favorite things that you found out yourself that you wrote about, you know, during your research for this book?
Well, I think, first of all, I was under the impression that because Disneyland, was the first park and the only one that Walt ever actually walked in, that it was really the only park that could be that source of inspiration and source of motivation for the kinds of lessons that I like to write about that help us live a better life, be a better leader, and see our own dreams come true. And that simply wasn't true. The lessons out of Walt Disney World are different, but also equal and in some degrees maybe even more important than what we wrote about in the first book. You know, with regards to Epcot, I was reminded Walt hated to repeat himself. He never wanted to do a sequel. He felt as though that if you did something well, why would you go out and try and top yourself? And mm-hmm. and so Florida was never about doing another theme park. It wasn't about an East Coast Disneyland. It wasn't about Disneyland 2.0. He only agreed to do Magic Kingdom, or the equivalent to Disneyland, because he knew those resources and revenues were going to be necessary for what he was really up to, and that was the true experimental prototype community of tomorrow, the Progress City, the city of tomorrow that Walt had really dreamed about. And so he revolutionized cartoons with Steamboat Willie, and then he creates the first, you know, full-length animated feature film with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Then he gets into live-action movies, and at some level, Disneyland is really just an extension of the live-action movie, because he actually envisioned that we're stepping into the story, we're stepping into the movie screen when we go through the tunnels of the Magic Kingdom, stage left and stage right. And by 1960, to some degree, he's already kind of bored with Disneyland. And what he really wanted to get into was urban planning. What he really wanted to do was solve the problems of the inner city. And the idea that he chose Central Florida, he settled on that piece of property after looking at St. Louis and Niagara Falls and New York and Washington, D.C. He settled on Central Florida the day that he flew over that swamp on November 22nd of 1963, which was the day that President Kennedy was assassinated in downtown Dallas. And it was that event that convinced him, I can't wait any longer. The world needs a new city. It needs a new vision today, not tomorrow. So that's what forced him to make the commitment to go to Central Florida and eventually acquire the 27,440 acres. Of course, Walt would unfortunately die of lung cancer in December of 1966. Roy would come out of retirement to see his younger brother's final dream come true, at least the first phase, which was always going to be the Magic Kingdom. And by the time they got around to Epcot, with Walt gone, so too was the vision and so too was the leadership. And so the company took a bit of a safer route. They did what they knew they could do well, and that is another theme park. I love Epcot. I love Future World and its emphasis on technology and tomorrow. I love the World Showcase. But at the same time, it's not the city of tomorrow that Walt envisioned and that Walt dreamed of. I think they kind of did the best that they could with the recognition that Walt, the visionary and the innovator, was gone.
Right. That's amazing.
I think it's an interesting point, too, that, you know, Walt didn't, you know, I hear people all the time evoke the name of Walt. Oh, what would Walt think? What would, you know?
And I'm like, Walt must be rolling over in his grave.
Yeah, well, yeah, right.
Can I say something about that, Jimmy?
Huh?
The second chapter in the book is Learning to Let It Go. And I write about Walt's death, and I write about some of the disappointment that people feel when the company chose to change that vision for Epcot. And what's fascinating is Walt's been gone more than 50 years now. And people who never met him, never knew him, never worked with him, just sort of assume that they know exactly what Walt would think and exactly what Walt would do. And yet if you talk to the people who knew him well, who worked with him every day.
Completely different story.
They'll be the first people to tell you, we never had a clue what Walt was going to do next.
Well, you know, just to your point that, you know, people will be like, oh, well, Walt would be worried. Walt wouldn't like what would happen with the theme parks today. I'm like, Walt would be so – if Walt was alive today, he'd be so beyond theme parks. Because just like you said, he did one thing. He'd figure out how to master it. And then that was it. He would kind of shove that aside and let other people run that. And he'd move on to his next thing. He was past that. Like, Walt wouldn't even be thinking theme parks at this point. He would be on it wouldn't be urban planning because he would have already mastered that. And whatever the next thing after that would have been is what he'd be on.
We'd have flying cars.
Yeah, he'd be working on flying cars. It'd be something like that he could master.
It's like Steve Jobs and Apple. You know, if Steve Jobs hadn't died 6 years ago, I don't think we'd be on the iPhone 8. We'd be on something completely new and completely different. And so, you know, there's some important points there. First of all, I think Walt would be thrilled that the parks are still going and that the sun never sets on a Disney park anywhere in the world today, which is pretty awesome. That's for amazing. A crazy dream that his wife didn't believe in and his brother didn't believe in. And everybody else told him it won't work and it'll be shuttered and bankrupt in 6 months or less. At the same time, even the dream of Epcot, and I think what hurts us a little bit is Walt as a filmmaker, his final film was the Epcot film. And that sort of freezes into place that dream and that vision. And then Walt dies about 5, 6, 7 weeks later. And, you know, he's sort of let off the hook in terms of, you know, executing everything that he talks about in that film. But we forget, he says in that movie, everything that you see here is going to change. Everything that you're looking at is just sort of a prototype, which is really his way of saying, this is the dream, but we don't really know exactly how we're going to pull this thing off. And even before Walt died, there are memos in his own handwriting where he's already changing things. So, for example, Epcot was originally supposed to have permanent residents, but then Walt realized, well, I'm not going to have the kind of control that I want and the kind of control that I'm accustomed to if we have permanent residents. So he'd already changed that and marked it over to temporary residents. So Epcot was always changing and always was evolving, just like Disneyland was. Look at the original map for Disneyland that was drawn by Herb Ryman. It's kind of what they opened in 1955, but yet at the same time, it kind of isn't either. So even if Walt had lived, Epcot wouldn't have been fully realized exactly the way he drew it out and the exact way that he explains this to us in that film.
That's a good point. Definitely.
Yep, I agree. And I think people don't understand that. They think they see one little clip that he did and say, well, that's the way he wanted it. Well, that's the way he wanted it at that moment.
Yeah. I think the lesson there is we have to be flexible. We have to be ready to change. Life is about change. And when it comes to dreams and success, leadership, and the opportunity to be entrepreneurial, you have to learn to pivot. And Walt was always pivoting. He was always looking for that next. And I think we're going to be a lot happier, a lot more satisfied, and a lot more successful if we're willing to change, if we're willing to pivot, and we're willing to be looking for that next as well.
I completely agree.
You got to adapt, constantly adapt. Well, that's fantastic, Jeff. And we appreciate you coming on. We love talking to you. And now I'm definitely going to have to call you when I go out to Disneyland and have you.
I think we could talk all night long. So much to discuss.
Tell us where the best place for people to get your book?
Well, the best place is to visit me at thewisdomofwalt.com. Both books, The Wisdom of Walt, Leadership Lessons from the Happiest Place on Earth, and Beyond the Wisdom of Walt, Life Lessons from the Most Magical Place on Earth. Both books are available at my website, again, thewisdomofwalt.com. You can purchase a personally signed, beautiful hardcover book from my website, but there you'll also find a link to Amazon. And on Amazon, you can get a paperback version of both books. You can get a Kindle ebook version of both books, and you can also get the audiobook version. So all modes are currently available. And again, thewisdomofwalt.com, and you can either get one signed personally from me, or you can go ahead and click Amazon and get either the soft cover, the ebook, or the audiobook.
We'll make sure and put a link to the book in Amazon in the show notes. And how can people follow you, Jeff?
Sure. So you can find me on Facebook, Jeff Barnes, and you can find me on Instagram, Dr. Disneyland, and you can find me on Twitter, again, Dr. Disneyland.
Anything else we missed that you want to cover?
No, I just, again, the books are a lot about Walt. I think what helps these books stand out is they're very park-centric. So it's not just biography, and it's not just history, and it's not another Disney business book. There's a lot of great Disney books out there, and I didn't really want to compete in that marketplace. But at the end of the day, the books and the stories are really about you, the reader, and your love for Disney and your desire to bring a little bit of that Disney magic home in what you do each and every day. So the response has been phenomenal. Right now, The Wisdom of Walt is the number one book on Amazon in amusement parks and theme parks. And Beyond the Wisdom of Walt, which has only been out for a couple of weeks now, is on Amazon as a number one new release. So
congratulations. That's
thank
great.
Thank you to everyone for you know, helping make this so successful. And, you know, if I can help anyone with, you know, their own dream and their own success, again, look me up on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and I'd be happy to have a conversation with you.
Jeff, I know you're doing research for book three, so where will Walt's wisdom take us next?
Well, I'm already sort of working, at least research and reading-wise, on the worldwide Wisdom of Walt, and that would be about the international parks and maybe even some of the cruise ships as well. We did our first Disney cruise in July and just had an amazing experience. And so it's really going to be about not just the history and the stories of those parks, but I also want to make sure that there are true life and leadership and success lessons that resonate with whatever those stories and whatever those histories are that I managed to uncover. And then I don't talk about this a lot, but there's a book in the marketplace titled If Disney Ran Your Hospital. And I would really like to write a book titled If Disney Ran Your University, because my background for the last 20 years is in higher education. I love what I do. I just don't always love the way that we do it. And so I'm intrigued around the idea of adapting Disney into a university setting.
How's the class going now?
So we only teach it in the summer. A couple of reasons for that. One, it's very field trip centric, which feels right for a summer course. Sure. I take the class to the park twice. And the reason for that is we split the class in half. And then by doing so, it allows them to invite friends and family members, which they inevitably do. So I end up taking two trips in the summer with the class with a group of about 25 or 30. And if we only went once and they brought friends and family, you know, I'd end up like one of those big groups and I need like colored shirts and a flag. And I don't
sure,
want to do that.
Right.
So, you know,
everybody,
so that's,
everybody would have to be from Brazil.
I wasn't going to say that, but
it's okay. I can. I'll catch some heat over it. Just if you're upset about my comment, email Ed at the Disney Nerds Podcast.
No. Y'all tag Jimmy in the group.
we were in Orlando in July, and we went to blasphemous, I know, but we went to Universal, and there was a Brazilian tour group, and they all had on their Walt Disney World shirts, and it was so confusing. And then the next day, we're at Walt Disney World, and we ran into the exact same group, and they all had on their Universal shirts. So, you know, I was walking away from there going, I don't understand.
I don't get it.
So anyway, we split the class in two, and so I end up taking them to the park twice, and then we go over to Garner Holt. We capped the class at 20 students, and again, part of that is because for the logistics of the field trip, we don't want it to get too terribly large. And Garner Holt is so gracious in allowing us to tour their production facilities, which, in my opinion, is really the true highlight of the class. And we can't have more than 25 on that particular tour. And so, you know, we've got 20 students and, then, you know, a couple of, you know, chaperones and other folks who are interested. And again, but every summer, May to June, and it really is probably the highlight for my year.
So the university has, like, some type of deal with Disneyland that all gets worked out with the students, or do the students have to have passes, or
so,
is that included with their cost of the class?
Well, again, this is kind of unique to Southern California. Almost every student who registers already has an annual pass.
Probably has the pass. Right?
Oh, yeah.
I was just curious. Yeah, I didn't know if that was something that Disneyland supported and it was kind of part of the, you know, part of some type of package you guys had with them.
You know, my dream job would either to be a tour guide at Disneyland or a Jungle Cruise skipper. But I'm interested in earning that sort of wage because I got food to put on the table and, you know, a roof to keep over the head and kids to put through college. Sure. And so what I really love about all of this is I've managed to sort of create my own dream job while, you know, raising my level of income rather than reducing it. And so I don't have an official relationship with Disney per se, but they absolutely know what we're doing. And I've actually had the honor of going into the park and speaking to cast members for various events from time to time. But no, we work everything out on our own. I don't have any special deals or, you know, special relationships. I pay for my pass, you know, just like everybody else does. But it's been a thrill, and you know, Nikki and I, we do it together, which I think makes it even more special. And you know, the passion is still there, and we love what we do because we get to do more of it, and we get to meet wonderful folks just like you, and hopefully some of your listeners and eventually readers.
Awesome. Well, we know, we pretty much know for a fact that Disney listens to all our shows. Because we've said things before that have just come to fruition for whatever reason. So we firmly believe that they're listening and they follow our instruction.
So if I were to say, hey, Disney, start carrying the Wisdom of Walt series in the parks, maybe somebody would listen.
Well, don't be surprised if somebody from Disney doesn't contact you and partner with the university for that class and offer some type of perks or some extra special stuff, because to me they should be promoting that, you know, as best they can. I mean,
I see the park as the world's happiest classroom, and you know, Walt wanted it to be an educational space, and you know, we're maximizing that vision for him.
I was lucky enough. Me and my wife and some friends, Lisa and her wife, who took us, who's also on the podcast, took us in this past January on the Keys to the Kingdom tour in Walt Disney World. Mm. And it blew my mind. It was like the best 5 hours. Obviously I wouldn't recommend it for any, you know, somebody going on their first trip, but once you've made the decision that you're a Disney nerd and you really want to dig into some details, that was so, so fantastic. Just they did a fantastic job.
Yeah, you know, we're trying to decide on those sorts of experiences when we're there next month. And I was literally just looking at that description today because I've always wanted to do it. And, you know, the challenge is, you know, I the idea of doing a 5-hour walking tour in July in Central Florida isn't particularly appealing to me. By the way, I grew up in the Panhandle. I actually went to college 2 hours from New Orleans, so I'm very familiar with that weather in the summer.
Sure.
But now here we are, we're going in November, and I'm like, ooh, do I want to, you know, I really want to go around and see all of the, you know, holiday stuff. And so, the Keys to the Kingdom and the Utilidors don't feel quite right in November either. But we're going to do it at some point. It's absolutely a bucket list item.
I would tell you, I don't know that it would be terrible in July.
Okay.
Now, I get the weather's terrible in July, but look, I mean, the tours start about 8:30 in the morning.
Okay.
And there's lots of opportunities that you're either on an attraction or riding, you know, you ride a couple attractions, then you're the latter part, then there's a break for lunch, and then the latter part, you kind of end up in the Utilidors for a large portion of that, which obviously is all air conditioned. So I don't, you know, I think, you know, by the time you're done, it's the middle of the day, probably the hottest part of the day. But the morning, I don't think you'd be miserable. Put it that way. I don't know if it'd be optimal, but I don't think you'd be miserable.
Sure. Good to know.
I highly recommend it. I was always one, you know, and even, you know, if you go back in older podcasts, I was always a little leery about doing a tour like that because I just didn't know if I wanted to know kind of the back. I didn't know if I wanted to peek behind the curtain.
You didn't want to break the magic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm so glad I did, you know, and Lisa took me. It was a surprise for my birthday, and they took me and my wife, and I'm so glad I did it because it didn't ruin anything. It actually enhanced everything. It made me even more interested. It even drove the passion a little more.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
And again, I wouldn't say that, you know, if you're a first-time visitor or you're a once-every-other-year visitor, I don't know if that's a a tour you probably want to go on. But if you're going multiple times a year and you want to really dig into details and learn more about the history and the stories. Well,
and that's where we are even with Florida now, because I was there last October. We were there in April. We were there in May. We were there in July. And so we're getting to that point where even though we live in Southern California, we go to Disneyland 2, 3, 4, 5 times a month. We're finding ourselves in Orlando frequently enough to where we're starting to say, hey, what haven't we done? What else can we do that's just going to help us enjoy this park as much as we enjoy Disneyland?
All right.
I would highly recommend the Keys of the Kingdom.
Cool.
Jeff, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. You're a fantastic guy, and I hope everybody heads out to your website and buys a book. We'll put a link to the Amazon, to both books on Amazon in the show notes. And we truly appreciate your time coming on. I know your time is very valuable to you, and it's always amazing talking to somebody who has the same passion as we do. And it's always nice making new friends. And I think we're friends on Facebook, and I've seen you post before, so I'll try and keep track, and hopefully we cross paths either in Walt Disney World, or I'll definitely be hitting you up when I head out to the West Coast.
Do not come to California without hitting this up and giving us an opportunity to give you our Disneyland tour.
I want to come to California just for that. Honestly, yeah,
for real.
I was there just a few months ago. I'm ready to come back anyway. So now I have even more reason to want to come back.
Well, we must have crossed paths because we were on that Disney cruise when you were out here for D23.
Yes, you were coming this way, and I was going that way.
Yep.
So, well, Jeff, thank you again for coming on. I really have to say you are so pleasant to talk to, and I really love that you are practicing what you preach and what you're writing and what you're putting out to the world. You're living it as well.
Living the dream,
absolutely, and putting it forward. You're moving one step forward. You made this your class happen. You made these books happen. So you keep moving forward and envisioning what's next. And I love that you're applying that to your own life while you're bringing that to your readers. Because, there are people that write books. Exactly, and to the young people.
Yeah.
So it's just fantastic. And we really appreciate you being on with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Charlotte. Thank you, Jimmy. And to all of the listeners, see you real soon.
Quaharini.
Just keep swimming.
So hurry back.